case.
Okay, thank you. So I'll talk about an ongoing project with Fadi Bishara, Yuval Grossman, Ronnie Harnick, who's here, Dean Robinson, and Jing Shu. See, okay, so the goal of what I want to talk about is that there's, I think, hopefully three messages should come across. So first I want to show that there are observables in Higgs 2 diphotons, which are linear in CP violating parameter. Then that the effects can be order one, and then as you see that the measurement of this CP violating effects is really challenging. So the question is whether this can be done at the LHC upgrade, or you can only do it at Higgs factory. So that's the warning. No, it's sort of a futuristic measurement. Now the motivation is the following. So as many speakers before, you can consider types of new physics which would modify the Higgs couplings, and most of the studies really focus on the CP conserving case. So you have a CP conserving new physics. Now what about the CP violating phase, the CP violating case? So for instance, you could have new physics which would generate this type of Yukawa coupling, where you have a pseudoscalar coupling to the Higgs, and Ronnie talked about that a few days ago. Now what I'll do here is I'll focus on Higgs decays to vectors, and in most of my talk I really talk about the Higgs to diphotons. So let us compare the Higgs to two photons and the Higgs to ZZ. So if you look at the Higgs to ZZ, there's the dimension 4 coupling, which you will find in the standard model. So that is going to be a three-level generated coupling to the Higgs. Now we know that experimentally that the Higgs is a CP even state scalar, which is preferred at more than 3 sigma, so that this part here is definitely there. Now at one loop you can also generate the dimension 5 couplings, which would be these two beasts here. So that's the piece which is in the standard model. So in the standard model the Higgs to diphotons is generated at one loop. But if you have also CP violating contributions, then you also generate these operators in the second line. Now what you see is that if you want to measure CP violation, then you have the following obstacles. So in a perturbative new physics case, you're generating a dimension 5 operator for Higgs to ZZ, which is CP violating at one loop, but you have to compete with the three-level contribution. So what you need is, in order to have a meaningful measurement, you sort of have to aim at the precision which is at the per mil level for Higgs to ZZ. So the meaningful number here is having a branching measurement or the differential measurements which are at the per mil level. Now if you're looking at the photons, you see that both the standard model piece and the new physics are both generated at one loop, so you might have a hope of having large order one CP violating effects in Higgs to diphoton. Now, the bad thing is that if you look at other constraints, so you look at the low energy constraints on CP violation, you find out that if you look at the electron EDM, there's already a bound on the following combination. So the electron Yukawa times this Higgs to diphoton coupling, and this gives the coupling which is smaller than 10 to the minus 2 if you assume that there is a standard model electron Yukawa for the Higgs. So what that means is that the bound vanishes if this Higgs that we're observing does not couple to electrons. So as we know, we only have direct experimental evidence that it's coupling to the third generation. So if it doesn't couple to the second and the first generation, this would go away. Or if this coupling to the electron is purely CP violating, in that case also this thing would vanish. So keeping this in mind, I think it's still important to have an independent measurement of directly Higgs to diphotons CP violating effects. Okay, so let's focus on that. CP violation in diphoton Higgs decays. So I said there are two operators. The first one is CP conserving, the second one is CP violating. They're both generated at one loop. So how would you measure CP violating coupling? So C tilde. If you look at the rate, normalized to the standard model, you'll have a contribution which goes as the CP conserving coupling squared plus CP violating coupling squared. So the sensitivity to CP violation, if you're only looking at the rate, comes at a quadratic order in CP violating coupling. Furthermore, the two always add up. So in a way, if you have an enhanced Higgs to Dye photon, that could be a good thing. Now it always adds up. But you would really want to have not the quadratic sensitivity to new physics, but maybe something which is linear. So what can you learn from the differential rates for Higgs to Dye photons? Now, the problem is that Higgs is a scalar. So there's no information on C tilde if you look at the angular distribution of the photons. So you'll learn nothing about the CP violating effects if you just look at the angular distribution of the photons. So what you need is a measurement of the polarization of the photons. So that's depicted here. So you can think of an idealized experiment where I have a Higgs decaying into two photons. The right going one has a linear polarization, which I call epsilon 1. The left going one has a linear polarization, which I call epsilon 2. And what you want to measure is you have an experimental device which measures the polarization of these outgoing photons. The angle between the two polarizations is phi. Let's call it phi. Now, if you have CP violation, the differential rate d gamma d phi, so depending on what the angle between these two polarizers is, will go as cosine squared of phi plus xi, where xi is the CP violating observable. So xi CP violating parameter. So xi are defined as the arctangents of C tilde over C hat. So C tilde was the CP violating coupling, C hat was the CP conserving one. So you see that if you have a measurement which measures the polarizations of the photons, this will end up as observing a shift in this sinusoidal distribution of the differential rate. So in terms of the CP violating couplings, you see that there is a shift in the modulation of the rate. It's linear in CP violating parameter, so that's good. And therefore, you would think that you're more sensitive to CP violation than just looking at the rate itself. Okay, so where is this coming from? Another way of thinking about this is that the sensitivity is really coming from the interference of two helicities. So if I have a plot in a nice basis, if I have plus plus helicity for the outgoing photons and the minus minus helicity states for the outgoing photons, so the effect of the CP violating parameter will be that there is a phase shift on the outgoing states. Therefore, so the message of this slide is that you will be sensitive to CP violating phase only if you have an interference between these two states. So somehow you have to have an observable which will project out the interference between these two states. So that's sort of the usual stuff when you're looking at CP violating observables. You're really sensitive to some interference effects. So because you have this interference term, therefore your sensitivity to CP violation is linear in the CP violating parameter. Now the problem is, how do you really measure a polarization of a 60 GeV photon? No, that's the problem. How do you measure a polarization of this very, very hard photon? Now, what you can remember is that 50% of the photons convert in the silicon trackers of CMS and ATLAS. So the idea is, can you use this? So the idea is the following. You have a Higgs decays to two photons. These photons propagate. They hit the detector. There is one photon hits the detector, and the other photon hits the detector in some different part. They convert by interacting with the nucleus into E plus E minus pairs. And if you would measure the angle between the planes of E plus E minus on one side and E plus E minus on the other side, that hopefully will carry some information about the polarization of the photons. So that's the main idea. The level of the amplitude is the following. So the same story, but I just tell it in terms of the amplitude. So I have a Higgs decays into two photons. They propagate long distance. So I have on-shell photons. They convert on the nuclei. So there's one nucleus and the other nucleus. So there I have two branches. The first branch and the second branch, they're spatially separated. And from the interaction of the photon with the nucleus, I create an E plus E minus pair. So that's the Bethe-Heitler process. There's some momentum exchange with the nucleus, and you create the first pair of E plus E minus and the second pair of the E plus E minus. Now what you see is that this is a 3-to-6 process, so it's a relatively involved kinematics in principle, unless there, it's a relatively involved process to understand the whole kinematics, but I see there are some simplifying things that are going on. Okay, now let me talk about the experimental challenges. So how experimentally difficult is this proposal? There's a few things that one should worry just doing back of the envelope estimates. So should I worry about the decoherence? So luckily the answer here is no, because the photon plus silicon cross-section is dominated by Bethe-Heitler conversion. So this is the dominant process, which means that there's essentially no interactions with material before you do the conversion. So the first interaction with the material will really be the conversion. So there's not going to be any decoherence of the polarization going on. Now, the other problem is that you need to determine the E plus, E minus orientation. And in order to do that, you need to measure the opening angle. Now, the opening angle, these are highly relativistic systems. You need to measure opening angles which are sort of 10 to the minus 4 ballpark. So half of the events will have opening angles which are larger than this 10 to the minus 4. So that's the ballpark, 10 to the minus 4. Maybe you can live with 10 to the minus 3. And the 10 to the minus 4 opening angles correspond to 50 micrometers over a lever arm of a half a meter. So that's, if you look at the pixeling of the detector, so there the precision that you can get, this is really a dilemma of the limit of what the present silicon detectors are capable of. So that's the challenge. Another experimental challenge is that you'll encounter multiple scattering of the outgoing electrons. So for instance, if you have a ballpark 0.01 radiation length of material that you traverse, then the scattering angle of 10 to the minus 4 is the typical multiple scattering angle for a 10 GeV electron and 10 to the minus 3 for 1 GeV electron. What that tells you is that, of course, this will be a challenging measurement, but it's not dead from the start. So you could potentially still determine the E plus E minus orientation on a statistical basis. Now, in order to really have a meaningful answer, there should be a realistic detector study. And what I'm doing here is just the first step. So where I mostly deal with the theory aspects beyond these two pages. OK, so what we have done. So we have analytical results for the Higgs-Bethe-Heitler. So that's the Higgs plus these Bethe-Heitler conversions using Feynman diagrams and also the spin helicity formalisms. We built a Monte Carlo program for Higgs-Bethe-Heitler process, so this Higgs with the conversion. Now, it uses Mathematica. I mean, you might laugh because it's not the first thing you could think of. But the reason is that we found out that when we try to do this with MADGraph, you need quadruple precision, and that got hairy. So it turned out it was easier just to write this Monte Carlo in Mathematica and keep the precision. I mean, it's not this is not really a difficult process when you do a Monte Carlo, no? It's not, the speed is not the problem. It was really the precision. So, okay, eventually maybe it would be useful to have a C++ code, but, that's just how we did it. Now, the goal right now is to understand where this sensitivity to CP violation comes from and how large it is. So what I'm doing, I'm just leaving backgrounds aside.
But the backgrounds
aren't
the exception.
Ah, very good. Do you want to talk in the microphone so I can?
No, forget
ah.
it.
So comment about the background. Yeah, it's true. So the background, if you look at the Higgs to gamma-gamma, in the modes that are being used now is your orders of magnitude. Okay. Ah, but there's the nice thing that the TTH, where H goes to two photons, has a very small background. So this is a futuristic measurement. So, you know, it might happen that actually the TTH will be the best mode. No, I mean, we're talking 3,000 inverse phantom bars, no?
Why not VBF?
Yeah, VBF is another one, but all this, I have nothing to say how much the background kills you. So VBF also has a small ground. Yes, yeah. It's that's why I'm saying right now, I'll just take the signal and see if I can have, what's the size of the effect? Now, I mean, if the effect is super small, then nothing will help you, no? Okay, so let's see where we end up. So let me count the observables. So what are the CP-sensitive observables? So I just count the parameters, which describe this leptonic configuration. So I'm looking at Higgs, two photons, and then I have four leptons at the end. So I want to just describe the phase space of the four leptons. So I have, there's three parameters per each of these particles. So that's the phase space, which turns to four energies, and the rest is the angular variable. So 12 is 12 total. The energies are not interesting for CP violation, so let me look at the angular variables. So the three variables are just the global rotation of the system. So again, nothing interesting for CP violation. Now I end up with five angles. So the out of these, two are just the opening angles. So these two guys, they are inherent to the branch, so the opening angle on the left and the right branch. So again, this will not be sensitive to CP violation. Now there's two angles which measure the echoplanarity between E plus E minus and the photon. So how much E plus E minus and the photon form a plane. So if E plus and photon form a plane, how much the electron is away from the plane. So again, this is inherent to each of the individual branches. It's not interesting for CP violation. It doesn't carry CP violation information. So all these are not sensitive to CP violation. So this leaves us with a single angle which carries the information about CP violation. Now, the single angle, of course, is not uniquely defined. I can add or subtract any of these other angles. No? But there's just one which carries the information about something of the relative orientation of the two branches, and this is the CP violating parameter. This will carry the CP violation, the information about CP violation. Okay, so let me define this angle in the following way. I'll just take it to be the angle between the planes that is formed by the electron and the positron on one side and the electron and the positron on the other side. So it's the direct product of these two angles, of these two normal vectors, that would be a cosine phi, and this is a phi, which is this same angle I was showing all the time, so there's nothing confusing here. Now the next thing is, let's look at how big the size of the CP violation would be. So how big of an effect should we expect if I take this Wilson coefficient, which is the one in front of F at dual, let me take this to be order one. So order one means that it's really one loop. And look at the integrated effect. So I define the following global variable. So let me take the standard model distribution over the phase space and subtract a new physics distribution. So I want to know how big the differences are in different parts of the phase space, the absolute value, and integrate over this difference, and then normalize to the standard model. And these are called ZB. It depends on the size of the CP conserving and CP violating Wilson coefficient. And in a way, it's a proxy of the matrix element method sensitivity once you integrate over the full phase space. Okay, so that's the plot of ZB versus these two variables. That's the standard model. And the more red you are, the bigger the effect. ZB is zero when there's no effect, and there's a small effect when you have the rate being the same as the standard model. So that's this region here. On the color plot, you can't even see it. So let me blow it up, and let's see how big of an effect it is on this ZB variable. So I'm sitting on this most conservative case. You don't see an effect in the rate, but I still want to measure CP violation. So the most conservative case. You see, in this most conservative case, depending on what the Xi is, you're sort of looking at, I don't know, 3%, 5% effects. Okay, so that's the integrated effects. Now, the big question here is whether I'm looking at 5% effect everywhere in the phase space, or 5% of the phase space has an order one effect. Now, that's totally two different things. Now, the second one is much better because I can just cut out the regions where I'm sensitive, and that's it scales much better with the luminosity. Okay, so large effects. Let me look at this differential spectrum. Okay, I just rewrote this cosine squared as a cosine of twice Xi. You know? Yeah.
But it does have an effect.
It does have, it's sort of, I already see that if you just go through the material,